a man walking beside barbed wire fences.
If I say the word Holocaust, what springs to mind? Imagine something like this. A concentration camp. Barbed wire. Trainloads of victims. Gas chambers and crematoria. Places like Auschwitz and its system of mass murder.
A dissecting table in a shed.
I think most of us assume that this was always the predetermined destination, designed from the outset in some great master plan of extermination. But it wasn't. There was no master plan for this.
Its origins were chaotic and spontaneous.
In grainy black and white footage, Jewish men running.
In improvised mass executions.
Someone is dragged by the hair.
It's believed that more than 1 million Jews were murdered in thousands of random killings that erupted all across Eastern Europe. In a holocaust of bullets.
People standing in a freshly dug trench are shot dead while several Nazi soldiers watch, their bodies then covered with dirt, now flying over a vast forest.
Largely lost and forgotten for more than 80 years, this first chapter of the greatest crime in history is now being fully revealed for the first time. Thanks to newly discovered aerial photographs and advances in forensic detection. Finding lost victims, uncovering the true scale of the killing. It began in earnest in the midst of Hitler's invasion of the Soviet Union in June 1941. Atrocities grew in scale and savagery. Until just 6 months later, bullets gave way to gas in the first death camps of the Final Solution. My name is James Bulgin. I'm a historian and Holocaust specialist at the Imperial War Museum. And this film tells a story that has never been fully told, of the crucial 6 months that ignited the Holocaust.
How the Holocaust began. A thin white line under the title shortens until it vanishes. James climbs some steps outside a grey stone building.
If you're going to search for the events that started the Holocaust, Cambridge University Library might seem a strange place to look. But a researcher here thinks he can find that start point using Second World War aerial archives.
Hi, Chris.
Ah, James.
How are you?
Good to see you.
Good.
Right. Well, let me show you what we've been putting together. This is a map of the German reconnaissance and air survey photography taken during the Second World War. It represents something like 1.5 million air photographs taken by the Germans, primarily over Central and Eastern Europe. But if we're looking for the ramshackle beginnings of the Holocaust, as it were, the sort of ad hoc start of it all, one of the things that's really clear with air photography is that almost every action leaves a trace.
So they were capturing the evidence of their own crimes?
They were photographing the evidence of their own crimes. And there's a good example of this. Possibly, to me, this is the beginning of the entire sort of horrific process. This is Gardai in Lithuania. It's literally a stone's throw from the German border. Which is running there.
Proper border town.
A proper border town. And this is a village where the Jewish inhabitants, it was about 20%, 30% Jewish before the war. They would have lived in the houses of the two Jewish streets here, and the synagogue was here. And on the 22nd of June 1941, of course, the Germans pushed east, and within literally 24 hours of coming over the border, the Germans had destroyed the houses. And if you look, you can see this whole area here was burned during that day.
It's so striking to me that these forces come through here from this direction and, I mean, literally, what, within a few hundred metres of the German border, they come through and they... This incident happens here so quickly, so soon, so close.
Absolutely. Well, look at this. If you look here, you can just see a slight linear feature there.
Yep.
You can see it more clearly in this other photograph, which picks it out in snow. And you can see it just there. It's not part of the agricultural landscape, it's not a path. I think this is a trench. We have a certain amount of sort of testimony from the time to sort of indicate that this is precisely where the Jewish men had been marched up the street in which they had lived and were then shot to death and buried in that trench.
So I've been circling this question, how do we get to this huge, vast, catastrophic act of mass violence and mass murder? And it's possible, likely, that this is where it began.
It's very likely.
If Chris has found a possible start point for the Holocaust, why is it in the Soviet Union as late as 1941?
Footage of Hitler looking out of a plane window.
Hitler had always envisaged a world free of his two great enemies, Jews and communists.
Hitler steps off the plane and is greeted by soldiers giving Nazi salutes.
By 1940, he'd conquered half of Europe and had millions of Jews rounded up and put in ghettos. His intention had always been to get rid of them entirely, but there was no concrete plan for how to do it. Then, in June 1941, he set out to destroy his other great enemy, Bolshevik communism.
A propaganda film, the Bolsheviks have been repelled, their tanks are ablaze.
Hitler had always branded communism a Jewish conspiracy. So his invasion of the Soviet Union offered the perfect opportunity to target both enemies at once. Garzde, on the border of Soviet Lithuania and Nazi Germany, was right on the front line of that invasion.
An animated map shows the Nazis encroaching into Soviet territory. James is driving.
The Wehrmacht, as they swept into this whole area, were charged with this instruction from Hitler and the commanders of the army that this was a war of annihilation. They were coming through this space to decimate it.
The order was for communism to be eradicated.
Heavy artillery guns firing.
No specific order was given to kill Jews. Yet there is a monument here in Garzde, exactly where Chris's photos showed a trench.
A stone monument with the Star of David at the top.
So on the 24th of June, 2 days after the German invasion of the Soviet Union, the commander in this area, a man whose name was Boehmer, instructed that 200 Jews should be rounded up and that they should be brought here and they should be shot. We tend to think of military orders within the German army at this period as all coming from the top, the people at the top telling the people on the ground what to do, but that's not what happens here. And that's really important, because actually what happens is people on the ground, like Boehmer, take their own initiative. Hitler has always wanted to remove Jews from Europe, and here these men take the initiative to interpret that in the most radical way possible, to interpret that as an instruction to murder. And this starts a process of mass murder that spreads like wildfire across this whole territory, and the numbers grow and they grow and they grow.
Hitler's head of security was SS Chief Heinrich Himmler. Himmler had created special killing squads called Einsatzgruppen to follow in the wake of the army and eradicate Hitler's political enemies. Capitalizing on Boehmer's initiative, his deputy Heydrich issued an instruction that any Jew working for the communist state must be shot. 4 Einsatzgruppen teams were ready to carry out that order across all newly conquered Soviet territory. I'm following Einsatzgruppen A from Gardzde into Latvia, in a town called Liepāja.
A massive explosion.
Here, there was another fierce battle for control of the city.
Entering Liepāja, the Bolsheviks are still resisting everywhere. It must be taken street by street.
In the aftermath of the battle, the SS Einsatzgruppen went in search of Hitler's enemies. And we can see what they did with them in a unique piece of film shot by a German serviceman.
In the opening of this film here, we see a pit, looks to be freshly dug, and then the Einsatzgruppen soldiers are milling around, waiting. And there's this really hideous sense of anticipation, and then we see why. We see a truck arrive and people being loaded off the back of it. We can see it's clearly Jews. We know they're Jews because they're wearing patches on their front and their back. And the people doing the shooting are Germans. But around them, we see spectators around here. We see members of the Navy here, military here, and amongst them, just people. They're there in huge numbers. They're smoking, they're talking, they're clamoring to get a closer look to see what's about to happen. Group after group come and the people stay and they watch it. Here we can see this man just looking into the camera, suggests that he can see that he's being filmed as this is happening. He knows that this has been captured and that people will be watching this moment when he's gone.
A number of Jewish men stand in the freshly dug trench while spectators observe. The Jewish men are shot and their bodies fall heavily to the ground. A German officer turns and walks away. James is moved by the footage.
It's horrible. It's almost as if shooting Jews has become a spectator sport. What we see in this film is where we are a few weeks after the invasion. So the Wehrmacht start to push further into Soviet territory. The Einsatzgruppen are coming behind them and they're finding more and more Jewish communities to target. And they're keeping a running total of it as they go. They want to be able to report those figures up to Heydrich and Himmler. And Heydrich and Himmler are saying, no, we want more. Why have you done more? The commanders of the Einsatzgruppen sometimes get chastised for not killing more people. There's this impetus, this force to constantly find more Jews to kill. And we see that recorded here. We see the date, so 22nd of August, 41, 544 people. 23rd of August, 41, 7,525 people. And now they include Judenen and Judenkinder, women and children. It's only taken a few weeks from those first murders at Gardzde for this to accelerate. And there's a tally at the bottom. At the bottom of this document here, by the start of September 1941, it says 47,614 people. That's 47,614 human beings.
James studies the document on a laptop in a cafe.
The Nazis wanted to do more than just kill their victims. They wanted to erase them from memory. The graves of many tens of thousands have never been found. And that matters to Dr. Harry Joel. So much so, he's devoted his career to finding them.
You can't just hide the bodies. The bodies will be found. I'm trained as a physical geographer, geomorphologist, and people such as myself and academics and others need to say, let's take our tools that we use for other research projects and let's apply them to the Holocaust. We need to put closure to this.
It does line up brilliantly. The fish smoking building with the five smokestacks would be just beyond that modern building on the other side of it. So we can't see the pit from here, but if we back up.
Harry works with fellow US academic, Dr. Phil Reeder.
There's the pit.
And every summer for the last 7 years, they've been bringing teams of students to Eastern Europe in search of Holocaust victims.
We have a different perspective on it now, but if we look up where the two students are, they're standing where the crowd was standing. And there's a wall.
Today, they're looking for the men in the film.
But then as they run, look, there's the lighthouse.
Yes.
You can see the lighthouse right there.
Yep, that's it.
The film gives them landmarks they can locate on historic air photos of the site, allowing them to triangulate where the men were shot and where they should start their search.
But here's that road where they would have taken people here, and then we see all those cars parked and where they're actually dropped off.
So I think that's a good spot for in the video where they're getting out of the trucks. There's actually a structure right there.
Yep. And because you can see the people up on this side and people up on this side, and then they would run to the pit over here.
So the pit, to me, is right out here in front of us. Or at least that's the place to start.
Yeah.
The students measure out an area, then use equipment to scan the ground.
Judaic law forbids any physical disturbance of the dead. So they're digging with radio waves. Ground-penetrating radar gives them the ability to image any large feature buried in the earth, like a mass grave. After a few hours, they find what appears to be a buried trench, but it's facing the wrong way to be the one in the film.
It's literally in that direction, right? So it's almost 90 degrees off what we're expecting, looking at the photos and taking a look at it here.
Right, so maybe it means that there are multiple trenches, and you know, the video is just one point in time where that particular trench is being used. So there could be trenches everywhere.
After multiple passes of the GPR, another trench appears beneath the tarmac. And this one lines up exactly with the film.
As we take a look at this trench, it's pretty impressive. You know, this is 38 meters long. You know, this is probably the first or second time I've ever seen something like this.
Yeah, I mean, it stands out very clearly. I mean, from all the time spent watching the video, it fits very well with what we imagine the angle would be of the trench coming in towards the fortress.
And, you know, they were basically brought into the trench and fell against this side when they were shot.
Right.
Yep. All the pieces of the puzzle are here.
Yeah. But at the same time, there's more work to do.
Yep.
Most certainly.
The men in the film have finally been found. But it's clear there were more people shot and buried here than anyone ever realized. And further along the same stretch of coast, a few months after Liepaja's men, thousands of women and children were shot and buried in the sands. No one knows exactly how many or where their bodies lie.
A harrowing still image of bodies piled up behind a sand dune.
It's only since the fall of the Soviet Union that mass graves like these, lost for over 80 years, are being forensically investigated for the first time. But pioneers like Harry and Phil are just scratching the surface of a monumental task.
James stands on a sand dune and looks out at holidaymakers enjoying the beach.
In Latvia, there are more than 70 suspected Holocaust sites. Most are yet to be fully explored. The same is true in neighbouring Lithuania, with more than 200 suspected sites. What seems extraordinary is that there was a single Einsatzgruppe team of fewer than 1,000 men to account for an estimated 250,000 deaths across both countries.
A mass migration of people, many barefoot.
There's only one way that was possible, and it's one of the most disturbing aspects of this entire story. Widespread local complicity.
James is driving.
And there is evidence of that happening here, in the Lithuanian town of Alytus.
So we're just driving into the town now from exactly the same direction that the Germans came in on the 22nd of June in 1941. So on the very start of the invasion, this is where they were coming from, and behind them were these Einsatzgruppe soldiers with this task of looking for the town's Jews.
They found them in the town and the surrounding villages. And, according to Nazi records, nearly 2,500 Jews were rounded up and brought to be murdered in the nearby forest.
Here we arrive at the end of the town, and the very same road driven on through the center of Elitis becomes, you can see here, it's becoming a dirt track. And now we're in forest. And what I find really, really chilling and really unnerving is the fact that it's walking distance from the middle of the town.
But who brought the thousands of Jews here? And who killed them?
He gets out of the car.
Because the SS have fewer than a dozen men stationed in this area.
A memorial.
I'm here to meet the leader of Lithuania's surviving Jewish community. Faina Kuklianski believes her grandmother was killed in this forest. And she may have discovered who the killers were.
My grandparents were quite educated people, and my grandmother was a doctor in the hospital. Then the war started, and my grandmother was taken from the street and imprisoned by the local people.
She's held prisoner by local people?
Yeah.
And then what happened?
And what happened after that, nobody knows. But in any way, she did not come back.
A large memorial in the shape of the Star of David.
I asked the Genocide Center of Lithuania to do the research for me, especially on Alytus. And it's written here clearly that in 1941, in August, there were mass killing of Jewish children and women. The victims were asked to go into the pits, to jump into the pits, to lie. Then they were shot. All the people who used to work in the prison took part together with the students of Alytus school.
So this is local school students?
Yeah, of the school.
Participating in the shooting?
Yeah, and together with, they came together with the policemen with guns. And they confirmed that what my uncle used to tell me, that probably his classmates killed his mother.
Faina, that is such a difficult thing to comprehend, the idea that it was your parents' friends from school who were some of the ones who were actively participating in this process. They must have known her.
Her son was studying with Lithuanians in a Lithuanian school. Doesn't matter that they were citizens of Lithuania, that they live in the same city, but it should be Judenrein. Jews should be killed, and they were killing.
So her only crime was being Jewish.
Yeah. Well, that's enough.
Photos of the dead against the forest background.
Zinaida Kuklianski and more than 2,000 other Jews were murdered here. Not solely by Nazis, but also by their fellow citizens. No one knows where any of them are buried. There is a cluster of monuments here in the forest, but they were put up relatively recently, and no one knows if they mark any actual burials.
I do not know where my grandmother is. I would like very much to know where is her remains. The sculptures, I think it's more like art pieces, not like the document pieces, and I do not see any information here about the people. When were they killed? How many people were killed? Where the women are? Where the children are? Who are they? That we are missing that. We just do not know where they are.
You guys got everything?
Yep.
Okay. On up.
Finer has invited Harry and Phil down from Liepāja to try and put that right. But this forest holds a puzzle.
We know in August, September 1941, we had approximately 2,000 Jews being executed and buried at this site. So flags in, red, white. The idea that they're here is interesting, but where are they buried? Are they all buried at this location? Or are they buried at other locations within this larger forest? And so our job is to try to find those sites.
Their investigation is underway. The vast forest, then James is driving.
The murders in Alita's forest trouble me for another reason. The element of local collaboration. And what happened here was just the tip of the iceberg. A truth some Lithuanians are determined to lay bare. I'm heading to a small town just 20 kilometers from Alita's to meet a prominent author and Holocaust researcher called Ruta Vanagaita. Ruta introduces me to 94-year-old Ona Budrykina.
Here is James.
Here
is Ponia Onutė.
Hello.
And she is from England, and I'll talk to you, okay? And we'll go to the tilto, right?
Ona grew up here among the town's Jewish population, and she is the last known surviving witness to their mass murder.
Gerai, tai važiuosim pas mane mašinoje, gerai? We go with her in my car, okay?
Perfect. You said it's very nice to meet you.
Sakau, labai, labai smagu jūs sutikti. Ir kad labai, labai gražiai atrodot.
Is that comfortable?
Gerai.
Now, Ruta's driving with Orna beside her.
She's going to show where they used to live.
James peers out from the back seat. Is it far from town? Not far from the bridge.
Mm-hmm.
Down the hill, if it's still standing. You haven't been there for a while. No, not in a long time.
The massacre Ona witnessed took place on September the 9th, 1941. Not in the dark of a large forest, but in the open fields in front of the house she lived in as a child.
So what happened on that day?
Kai čia va pradėjo eit, tai batėsi ėjo ir ėjo.
There were a lot of people being marched down the hill.
And when did you see the first people coming past?
Ką jūs pamatėt tą dieną, pirmus žmonės, kaip jūs pamatėt?
Pamatė, užgirdo riksmą.
They heard the screaming.
Verksmą.
A cry and screaming.
Ir mes tik paskum, kai medžių buvo, tai tik proskėlė žiūrim, kas čia daro.
We looked through the windows only what's
going on. Tai ėjo, ir ėjo, ir ėjo.
There were hundreds of people being marched here.
Tai mama pradėjo verkti, ir mes visi verkėm.
My mom started crying, and everybody
else. But the screaming was the first thing that she heard before she saw anything.
Pirmas dalykas, ką išgirdot, buvo riksmas.
Taip, ir paskum užgirdom jau šaudimą.
And then we heard the shooting.
And who was in the column? The Jews, but...
Kas to, kokie žmonės buvo?
Čia ėjo... Jaunus, jaunų tokį pagyvenę ėjo.
Mostly old people.
O paskiau ėjo vaikai.
And tai, later on children.
O vaikus kitur šaudė.
And children were being shot in another place.
And when you heard the shots, you realized what was happening.
Ir kai išgirdot šūvius, tada supratot, kas vyksta.
No.
Yes.
Photos of the murdered men, women and children against the long grasses swaying in the breeze. She says, God save us, God save us. It all comes back to me when I can't sleep at night. More photos of the dead.
This past is in my head.
Ona looks solemn, flying over the village.
This is Butrimonis, where most of the victims lived. Its historic heart lies empty because that September day, 740 Jews, 80% of the town's population, were murdered. The question is, who by?
The killers were Lithuanian killer squad from Alytus coming to get rid of the Jews.
So we're talking about Lithuanians killing of the Lithuanians.
Yes, but they are not. They were those. The killers were not neighbors of those Jews, but those the policemen and the partisans were neighbors of the Jews who were killed. Yes.
And the whole process throughout has been managed by these people's neighbors, the people doing the roundups.
Yes, preparation was managed by people's neighbors, but killing was done by somebody coming from.
But
outside.
All Lithuanians.
Yes.
From another town nearby, and they're the ones who do the shooting. They're the ones with their fingers
on
the triggers.
And after the shooting, the neighbors are taking the property.
Wow. That's quite a thought, isn't it? And then they move into the houses around here, presumably they take over the town and all the Jews are gone.
Yes, in one night.
In one night.
It's clear that the Holocaust here was much more than just a series of spontaneous acts. It was rapidly evolving into organized ethnic cleansing on a massive scale.
He returns to the dense woodland.
In Alytus Forest, Harry and Phil think they may have stumbled on the biggest mass grave they've ever seen.
It's getting more pronounced here, Phil.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously, we're walking in a lower area that has, what to our left, a mound of stuff.
Yeah. Here, let's climb up. Wow. I mean, that's human built.
Most definitely.
Wow.
Human built.
I mean, it's macabre, but I mean, the idea that where you are was where the trench would be, and here you would be lining up people being shot, falling into the trench where you are, then burying with that sediment that you have, and then continuing that along here.
Right.
For potentially months here. This is a trench where you could have thousands of people.
Yeah.
This is one that is not, you could say, limited in number of people.
The discovery is the result of resolute detective work, because the trench is nowhere near any of the Holocaust monuments.
So we checked out the area of the monuments. All the data indicated, really, that there was nothing there. So I went back to the air photos to try to find something that potentially fits where a large number of bodies could be buried. And this is a 1944 Luftwaffe air photograph of this area. And if we zoom in, what's interesting about it is this is the road that we come in on, and these two roads that are coming off of it. And this particular road is essentially a road to nowhere.
So it's a road that goes into the middle of a forest and stops.
And stops. I would agree with that. But there is testimony of a family member soon after her father and brother were murdered, of visiting this site and seeing the evidence of trenches that were so fresh that they were stained with blood.
So that's what's at the end of the road?
Yes. That's what prompted us to start to look in this particular area.
And then we'll have two people going on this, and then one person will be moving the line.
And when, upon close inspection, we found a series of trenches leading up to, at least visually, potentially the largest trench. And this may be a mass grave or series of mass graves where there are tens of thousands of people buried.
The evidence is compelling, but it's only circumstantial. The only way they can be sure they have found a mass burial is to look beneath the surface, as they did so effectively at Liepāja.
So what we've done at this site is we've started collecting a grid with ground-penetrating radar. And now I'll show you a time slice as we go down into the subsurface.
Okay.
And remarkably, you know, this, we never know what we're gonna get. We see this feature right here. This is what we are interpreting as a burial trench.
So that, and that, because that's anomalous within the rest of this here. It's clearly something distinct
right.
about that.
It's rectangular. And so now we can start calculating the dimensions of a trench here. And it's not just here. It goes all the way up where this linear feature goes and goes all the way down.
Right down to the end there?
Right down to the, almost to the end, and it does a right-hand turn down there. And there's, so, I mean, we can't even start doing the calculations. We're just looking at the data right now. This is a large feature.
That's massive.
It's
all
huge.
All the way to there, all the way to there,
correct.
And then
we have 7 to 11 meters here on the tapes here. But take a look. All the trees have been taken out at 7 meters, and they're gone all the way to 11 meters. all the way down this way.
Walking past every day, I wouldn't have noticed this detail. Had you not, I wouldn't have noticed. But now you point it out, it seems so obvious that clearly something has happened to this earth. Something has disrupted the continuity of this space.
When we take, I mean, I just take a look out here. We thought there was going to be nothing out here, and we see some, you know, linear features and things like that. I'm shocked when I walk around now. I'm looking at things, and it's like potentially we are sitting on thousands of executed Jews at this site. We could work here for years and years.
Just find more.
Yeah.
The leafy forest canopy above.
I guess the experience of being here today has been a really stark reminder of the point about taking Jewish individuals into a site like this and murdering them. When the Nazis come into these territories, they find in various different ways and in various different capacities different people who are prepared to support it, sometimes to allow it to happen, but sometimes to become directly involved, to become the people who are the people with their fingers on the trigger. It's so important to remember that the Nazis were at the center of this, but they didn't act alone. They required the active participation of hundreds of thousands of people. They couldn't have done it without that.
From the forest to pedestrians on a cobbled street.
Like a lot of formerly occupied Eastern European nations, modern Lithuania has a history problem. Because the truth of its role in the Holocaust is finally coming out of the ground. And it's being obliged to face up to it by writers like Ruta Vanagaita.
In another 50 years, the people will come to terms with it.
Ruta, this is something that you've gone to great lengths to investigate. What happened when you did that?
My book about the Holocaust was published. It became a bestseller. But the reaction was very violent. Some people accepted it, but majority of my nation didn't accept. And I became like enemy of the country because I was like defaming my own people. And they called me a Jewish whore. So in the end, when, you know, people were attacking me and spitting at me on the street, I endured, and in the long run, I had to leave the country for a while until they forget me a little.
So speaking out came at great personal cost to you?
I don't regret. Yes, it did, but I don't regret. Had I known that it would be such a violent reaction, I would have done it anyway, because I spoke for the victims. This is my army, those 200,000 murdered people. This is my army. They gave me a lot of strength.
And if you published the book today, do you think you would get the same reaction?
No. They wouldn't be published. No
wouldn't
way.
Be published,
no. No way. And nobody, after me, nobody would write a book about the Holocaust, because people know that you lose your friends and you become a public enemy.
So what is said? When this comes up in conversation, what is said? What do
it's
people say?
It's a defense reaction, it's self-defense.
So they always say, it wasn't us.
Yes, kind of. I mean, I told my friend that I am coming to see the Butrimonius with the BBC crew, and she said, what? Are you going to tell the whole world again and defame our country? And tell everybody that, you know, we killed the Jews, the Lithuanians killed the Jews? I said, yes. She said, why? I said, because they did. So we are bloody uneducated. Uneducated. The school hasn't educated us. Our grandparents didn't educate us. Our grandparents were too afraid to speak about it. Who could tell us about what happened? So for the moment, Holocaust subject is closed. I don't know for how long.
Archive film of people handing flowers to soldiers.
80 years ago, many Lithuanians welcomed the invading Nazis for what seemed at the time to be a very sound reason. Because the Nazis were liberating them from communism. The same nationalist response manifested across all the Baltic states, as well as large parts of Ukraine.
The Ukrainian people welcome our soldiers as liberators from the terror of Bolshevism.
Everywhere, nationalists fanned the flames of anti-communism, And the Nazis pushed the myth of that communism as a Jewish conspiracy.
Film of people being roughed up and manhandled through a crowd.
As Hitler's invasion of the USSR reached its fullest extent, coercion and complicity across territories under Nazi control allowed the SS to initiate nearly 2,000 atrocities across 7 countries, from the Baltic to the Black Sea. Scaling up their murderous ambition in village after village, town after town.
From the map to a photo of people huddled together outside.
As victim numbers grew, the SS developed a system for ensuring maximum efficiency and minimal panic. It began with a calming ruse. Jews were told to assemble with money, belongings, and warm clothing. So they waited patiently, expecting to be deported. Then they were led away in groups, often by local police, to be shot.
A photo of a child, now film of crossing a metal river bridge, then barricades on the street.
When the Germans took the Ukrainian capital, Kyiv, in late September 1941, they claimed their biggest Soviet city so far, with tens of thousands of Jews. And SS commander Friedrich Jeckeln saw the chance to perfect mass murder on a monumental scale. He issued the standard order to the city's Jews to assemble.
All Yids of the city of Kyiv must appear on Monday, 29th of September, 1941.
Then he had them escorted out of town by local police along this road to a 30-meter deep, half-kilometer-long ravine called Babin Yar.
Film of the location.
Here they were stripped naked, ready for the waiting guns.
Archive footage of a woman at a microphone. I just saw that all the naked people were lined up in single file and taken through a small opening.
Jeckeln's plan was carefully engineered, yet Dina Pronicheva survived it.
She addresses the packed hall. They began to shoot everybody. I closed my eyes, clenched my fists, tensed all my muscles and jumped. I heard the Germans coming down into the ravine to finish off those who were still moaning. Some people in their death throes were hiccuping, convulsing and stirring. They shone their torches at people and shot anyone still alive. I felt this was the end. Images of clothing, shoes, and personal belongings left in the dirt.
These are the belongings of those who didn't escape. On 29th and 30th September 1941, Jeckeln's men shot 33,771 men, women, and children. 1,700 people an hour for 2 days.
A photo of the items in the ravine. James is driving.
Babin Yar was the biggest single massacre of the Holocaust thus far. Yet it would become just one notable landmark in a continental killing spree.
A cloud of dust blows up behind the car as James pulls up. He rolls a map out across the car bonnet.
By the end of 1941, over 1 million people have been killed under the hail of bullets that the Nazis and their collaborators have thrown at them. We've got 25,000 murdered here in Riga, 50,000 murdered here in Kaunas, 70,000 here in Ponari. We've got in Minsk, 30,000, in Kiev, 34,000. In Kamianets-Podolsky, we've got 25,000, and down in Odessa, we've got 30,000. Hundreds of thousands of Jews and thousands more between all of these places. But it doesn't start as a plan of total annihilation. That's something that evolves as part of these operations here. What they've been able to do here conceptualizes something within their minds they hadn't previously anticipated in this way. They can kill them. They can kill them, and they can kill them, all of them, across the whole territory. But the largest number of Jews still alive are here in occupied Poland. They're living in ghettos, they're living in terrible conditions, they suffered appallingly during this period. But there's been no central plan to annihilate them until now. And that's what changes at the end of 1941.
Archive film of Jews crowded together in the street. They have Star of David Jewish badges on their clothing.
But when the Nazis set out to murder the millions of Jews languishing in their ghettos, they did not use millions of bullets.
James is projecting images onto a tent.
By the end of 1941, after more than a million individual murders, mass shooting had become unsustainable.
And when we look at these photos, we start to understand why that is. You can see here these young men are facing other human beings and killing them. And they're seeing what they're doing firsthand, face to face. And what senior Nazis become really concerned about is the mental health of the people that are doing it. Never the people that are being killed, the people that are doing it. Because they know that that's something which is going to be impossible for them to deal with. They talk about it as a burdening of the soul. There's reports here of these soldiers getting nausea, nervous tension during the massacres. In many cases, killers suffered vomiting attacks or developed severe eczema or other psychosomatic disorders. You know, this sense that this whole generation will be corrupted forever, irreconcilably corrupted by what they've been asked to do in the name of the Reich.
The other big factor was location.
Everything that's happened so far, everything that I've looked at, has happened a long way from the heart of Germany. It's in this kind of this wild east in the Nazi imagination. It's a different place where different things can happen, different permissibility. We see here an absolutely indescribable scene of carnage, and it's so public and it's so barbaric and it's completely grotesque. And even the Nazis find this kind of scene unconscionable. Killing hundreds of thousands, millions of people is something that they can accept. But from their perspective, as things develop, there are ways that it should be done, and this isn't it.
A photo of bodies piling up as they're thrown from a train carriage.
And so they need to find a new means of mass murder that can be scaled up, that can be efficient, that can be secret, and that can be civilized. In their mind, much more closely aligned with this new Germany that Hitler wants to create.
One of the men tasked with finding those new civilized ways of killing was an SS major called Herbert Langer. And this forest, called Kazimierz Biskupi in the west of Poland, is what Langer was given to use as a laboratory.
In the forest, someone takes a map and some tools from a box.
A team of researchers from across Poland is attempting to find the evidence left behind by Langer's experiments. Traces of mass graves can be seen in the Nazis' own aerial photographs. Agnieszka Nieradko hopes they will help locate extraordinary events described in eyewitness testimony.
A geophysicist is mapping the area.
This is part of our team. Hi. Hello.
Sebastian.
James. Sebastian Rzycki, Warsaw University of Technology.
Nice to meet you.
And Szymon.
Hello.
Hello. Szymon Ryski, Institute of Geophysics, Polish Academy of Sciences. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you too. Thank you. So what have we found here?
Okay, so that this is this depression here.
This
is
here.
Yeah. Yes, and you have a rectangular shape, and it could be the mass grave we are looking for.
Just where we're standing now. Could be one.
Yes.
From one perspective, it can look like just a regular mass grave from the war time. However, we know from a single testimony we have of a pre-war vet, Polish vet, who was brought here as a prisoner, political prisoner. He was brought here with 30 other Poles, forced to assist the Germans in killing Jewish people from a neighboring ghetto. So people were brought in carts here alive, and the pits were already waiting for them. They were not shot. They were just covered with quicklime and burned inside the pit.
So they dug pits, put quicklime into the pits?
Brought containers with water, brought people inside, brought containers with water and put the water inside. What made the quicklime to react chemically?
Boil.
And
with boiling people in?
Yes.
Exactly, yes.
Inside. And this is what we know from this testimony of a Polish vet. He was here from the very beginning until the end, forced afterwards with other Poles to bury the victims.
So, right where we are here, there was a pit in which people boiled alive.
Correct.
Do we know how long it took?
According to Sienkiewicz, several hours.
We think that is experimental killing site here.
Right where we're standing?
Yeah.
They were just trying out different ways?
Yes, different way of killing people.
Now, James is walking through the woods.
It's believed Langer killed 3,000 Jews here in a series of trials, which included not just lime pits, but mobile gas vans.
It was just a pure technical rehearsal of which method would be the most effective, efficient, as if the Nazis were just getting ready for the big task that was ahead, meaning killing the European Jewry.
Clearly, there's an intention as being consolidated from within the heart of the Nazi hierarchy, from Hitler, from the top down. There's this idea of this intention is becoming more and more and more determined towards a final solution, which is about complete annihilation. But of course, as an intention, that is meaningless without the means of achieving it.
Yeah.
And that's what we see.
Yes.
Here, the
yes.
actual practical means of achieving this, taking this.
This is what it meant. This is how I understand that. They are testing, they are trying, they are drawing conclusions. Lime, quick lime, is expensive. Gas in wagons was also inconvenient. So it just drives Lange to a natural conclusion that it doesn't work. We need to think about something else.
Yeah, yeah,
this
yeah.
is it.
And of course, the thing is that, we're talking about experimentation, but this is. The people that are being experimented on are real people. I mean,
yes,
that's
something we can't forget.
Anieszka's team continues to search the forest for more of Langer's victims. But Langer himself concluded that the answer he was looking for did not lie in forests. He'd found the most efficient killing agent was gas, but it needed to be used in a completely different location.
James is on the move.
What Langer realised, in fact, was that the future of mass murder lay in the past. In an old SS prison called Fort Seven. Here, in 1939, Langer had been part of a project called Action T4. T4 was created to purge the Third Reich of the disabled, what the Nazis called life unworthy of life.
archive film of people with disabilities. Now James is walking along an arched corridor.
And the key to T4's efficiency, Langer recalled, had been to bring the victims to the means of killing inside a special, secure facility. In this quiet old fort, Langer had improvised a whole new concept in mass murder.
He closes the heavy metal door.
What may be the world's first gas chamber?
He looks around the interior. The ceilings arched and lights shine on the brickwork.
People were led up here. The doors were closed behind them. When they were all in, clay was put around the edges outside to seal it off. And then tubes were put through openings in the door. Through those tubes, carbon monoxide was pumped from sealed bottles. And the people would wait outside. When there was no more noise inside, people outside knew that everyone in here was dead. By the end of 1941, it's become clear that Hitler's ambition is to murder every single Jew across Nazi-occupied and Nazi-allied Europe. And in order to do that, he needs the necessary scale. And that's what this offers. It needs development, and it's the development of that idea which is what leads us to the death camps.
James walks to the back of the gas chamber. A number of urns are displayed on individual wooden stands.
So these urns contain ashes from different camps across Europe. The one directly in front of me is from Helmno. This Helmno is where Herbert Langer went directly from here, and it became the first death camp. And from that, a network was developed that led to the murder of millions of people. And it all started here, in this room.
A solemn James turns and strides out of the chamber. Now a crematorium with a tall chimney.
From early 1942, millions of Jews were taken from all across Nazi-occupied Europe and sent to extermination camps, like this one, to become no more than ash and memory.
James approaches a memorial.
It took just 6 months to get here from the first bullets fired in the east. How did that happen?
He walks around the imposing mausoleum, one of the camp's original buildings and fences with barbed wire.
Of course there was Hitler's poisonous ideology, but it needed more than ideology. It needed tens of thousands of ordinary people to betray a neighbour, or turn their backs and say nothing, to help round up and rob, to sign an order, pull a trigger, or open a valve.
A crematorium oven.
To see others as sufficiently different from them to be killed.
James walks outside into bright sunshine. The buildings of the death camp lie ahead.